Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Peter Gago is one of the few enologists who could be described as a celebrity. He's been the chief winemaker at Penfolds since 2002, where he's only the fourth person to oversee the production of its most famous wine, Grange, as well as a distinguished range of other reds and whites. Listen to his chat about his English roots, his time as a high school teacher, the secrets of blending, and what it's like drinking wine with Bono, from U2. Hello, Peter, how are you?
Very good, thanks, Tim. Great to be speaking to you.
Likewise, been too long, I must say. I mean, where are you at the moment?
Far too long. Would you believe I'm not back in Adelaide town. I'm in Melbourne. I'm in lockdown, going on 9 weeks.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
But you're looking cheerful, so, or sounding
it. Yeah, can't complain too much. We've got a little place over here, so it's good, and you're allowed to go within 10K and all sorts of things. You know the drill. You've been through it all, so let's hope it ends soon. And let's hope the border opens soon between here and South Australia.
But you're tasting at home. You're doing all your samples and everything. I mean, all the blending.
I can do, at this time of the year, fortunately, about 95%+ of my work from home. So the neighbours think I have a bit of a problem. There are a few too many empty bottles by the bins. And I assure them it's a professional pursuit. But the continuum of bottles is worrying them somewhat.
Yeah. My neighbours think that about me as well, I think.
Yeah.
Listen, great to have you on the show. So many things I want to talk to you about, but I'm going to begin in England. I mean, I not many people know, I think, that you were born in Newcastle upon Tyne in the northeast of England. It's a bit cheeky, but can we claim you as an honorary Brit, do you think, or not?
Well, I have two passports, so you sort of can. Look, I left at the little age of six, so it's been a few years since then. But lots of rallies still over there. We were literally the only family to have wandered across a few oceans and that back in 1963, would you believe? It's a long time ago.
And why did your family move?
Well, my dad, post-Second World War, was conscripted into the British Army and said, oh, I want to go to Gibraltar, you know, back in the day, and got, used to the warm weather and went back to the north of England, black ice off his motorbike a couple of times, grabbed my mum. I was, going on six. My sister Sandra, 3.5. My brother Brian, 5 months old. And he said, we're going. And mum said, where? And the answer was, somewhere warmer. And we ended up in Australia. They didn't know a soul over here. It was quite amazing. Yeah, that was a while back.
What a great story. So without black ice in the northeast of England, no Peter Gago winemaker.
Yeah. No, well, that's it. And look, climate change, I'm sure we'll talk about that at some point. I don't think there are too many vines up there. There are down south.
Not
but
yet.
Who's to know? Never say never. Never say never.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you're a scientist, you know, you did a Bachelor of Science degree at Melbourne University, and then you became a high school teacher of maths and chemistry. I mean, I always think there's still a bit of the teacher in you because you're very good at communicating. I just wonder, what did you learn from that time in the classroom?
Oh, look, I think as much in the classroom as I ended up being a science department coordinator, all the teachers, there are about 16 in our department, all older than me. So you learn the managerial bit at that end. But I think, you mentioned communication, but just the active art of listening sometimes too, not being too domineering, never raising your voice, doing it all very nice and calmly, and sometimes too not rationalising too much, not explaining everything you do, because then that becomes an expectation that you've got to explain everything. But no, I had great success in teaching and didn't leave it because I was disenchanted. I could go back to it tomorrow. I loved it. But a few other things came my way, so I've been very fortunate.
Yeah. Well, because then at the age of 29, you decided to go back to university, to Roseworthy, and study enology. Had you already got the wine bug? I've seen you described it as the grip of the grape. Had the grape gripped you?
Yeah. Well, look, at Melbourne Uni, you know, we're all Australia, you know, drank a bit of beer, still do. It's not beer or wine. You can use the word and. And, it was trial and error, really, because I don't come from a family of wine people. So with friends and other friends and then other older friends. We sort of, yeah, it was literally trial and error. And the more you get into it, the more you get into it, as we know. So, yeah, bit by bit, did some little short courses and then ultimately ended up going to Roseworthy.
Yeah.
And they wanted me just to do a graduate year because I was already degree qualified in sciences and such like with a double major, 4 years at Melbourne Uni. And I thought, no, I'm not in this for the piece of paper. Let's do this properly. I'll do the full degree. So, yeah, ended up doing another one.
So what was that, 3 years?
3 years there. Now they're four, I believe. Yeah, degree in applied science and enology. So, yeah, it was great. I loved it. I put the lecturers on notice because, of course, when I can't remember how I got through my first degree. You know, you're growing up at that stage at 17, 18, and study's just something you've got to do. But in the second one, I put them on notice. The more they gave, the more I wanted. I just wanted more, more, more. So,
and you came top of your year. You were the Ducks, right?
Yeah, it was good in a way. Helped me fast track a little bit later going in as a mature age student. So that came in useful, yes.
Yeah. I mean, you joined Penfolds in 89, where you still are, obviously. I just wonder, how did you get the job?
Well, I actually applied and I still have the advertisement. It was an advertisement in the Adelaide Advertiser for a sparkling winemaker, would you believe? And as I found out later, I was to report into the infamous Ed Carr, who was the group sparkling winemaker, and did that for about 4 years. Yeah, loved it. And worked with Ed for the 4 years and loved that too.
I mean, he's famous as a sparkling winemaker. He's one of the most famous in Australia.
Yeah, yeah. You know, opened up Tasmania to sparkling and we're still very, very, very close. And, I didn't think it, and we'll talk about it later, I'm sure, get into it. Competing with him, so that's where champagne came into it, but we'll talk about that later.
And which grapes were you using? Were these Chardonnay Pinot blends or were you using other things?
Back in the day, we were actually winning trophies at the Adelaide Wine Show with Pinot Chardonnay blends under the Seaview label to a certain extent, Killawarra, Edmund Mazur label. We're often winning trophies with wines only on lees for 12 months, and a lot of this fruit did come even then from Tasmania, Tumbarumba in the Snowy Mountains and elsewhere. So now we're doing table whites out of some of those regions, but back in the day, sparkling.
So you already knew them as cool climate areas that were suited
back
to fit.
Over 30 years ago.
Interesting. Let's talk a bit more about Penfolds. I mean, it's a company obviously enjoys a prominent position in the Australian wine industry and all over the world, but it's one of those brands people feel a real kind of genuine attachment to. I think it's almost, I mean, it's emotional. It could even be visceral. I don't know. But why is that, do you think? Why do people feel so warmly about Penfolds?
Look, I think it is, especially in Australia, but that's been extrapolated offshore into some other markets now. People grow up with this thing called Penfolds. You know, I don't look upon it as a brand. I've always talked about it as a bit of a culture. But we have been doing business now for 177 years. And some of the great Australian winemaking stories. Well, in the mid-1800s, we were sending wine back to the mother country, England, in the mid-1800s.
Was that fortified?
Fortified predominantly, but a tiny bit of table wine we're finding out. A little bit of table wine, not much. Remembering back in the day, it was predominantly fortified made in Australia because of temperatures and just like the Portuguese, they had to get across an English channel. We had to traverse oceans. Fortification came in very handy. But, no, it was interesting. And, you know, we've done the odd launch at Blackfriars, the Apothecaries.
Yeah.
You know, Shakespeare used to rehearse in their halls and to do things there because Dr. Christopher Rawson Penfold was a graduate. He went through. You know, the leeches jars are there on the shelves still and all sorts of things happened. He left there, went to St. Bartholomew's. So we've got a very sort of strong bond with England, but also with generations of people who have moved to Australia and people who have followed this thing called Penfolds. And we've always sort of been a little bit on the innovative side too, but back in the day when Dr. Ray Beckwith worked with Max Schubert, things were a bit secret squirrel within wine groups. So, you know, not the world didn't sort of know what was going on, but they were doing amazing things internally back in the 30s, 40s and 50s. So, I don't know. And look, Grange, I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but it's helped create a little bit of a wedge for others to follow in the wake of in terms of global sort of, you know, trade, I guess. Yeah. So other wineries love this thing, Grange, begrudgingly sometimes because they're competitive, but, you know, what it's done for Australia and some of our other wines, including the Sonneries and other things like that.
Let's talk a little bit about Grange, if it's such an iconic wine. 2002, you were appointed as chief winemaker, and you're only the fourth person to make Grange since its first vintage in 51, after Max Schubert, the late Don Ditter, and, of course, John Duval. I just wonder, you know, two things. You know, does that bring an enormous sense of responsibility? Do you think, help? And how do you add your own stamp to something that's already iconic? How do you make a difference to it?
Well, look, it's a difficult one in a way, but we have this lovely safety net called the Penfold Winemaking Team. And within it, we have two branches. We have people like myself who are tertiary qualified or whatever. Yeah. And then we have other winemakers who've come through the School of Hard Knocks, call it what you will, from the lab or the cellar, all the way through. And it's a lovely, lovely sort of cultural thing. And with classification processes and such like, it's a very, very good way of having that sort of, you know, your driving wheels almost to help you in the direction you go. So, you know, the successes, whether they've been fortifieds, whites, reds, or now even sparkling champagne, it's a team thing. So when I took on the role, though, I must admit I disappointed many, many journalists when they first question they ask, of course, is, and you possibly asked this too, Tim, you know, what are you going to do to DeGrange? How are you going to make it better? What are you going to do? And I gave them two words. And the two words were absolutely, the first, and the second, nothing. You know, like the template's there. What we do, though, is we go through the world of the one percenters and refinements, and that's what we've been doing with that particular wine. Plus, of course, there are many other new and different ones, but the time-honoured ones, you know, 389 last year celebrated its 60th anniversary, Grange this year its 70th. Sonneries goes back to 1889. Not all the way back there with Penfolds. We resurrected the style in the 50s. But, you know, quite interestingly, you know, these have huge cachet. And it's not about ego and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. It is about those refinements and we do a lot of those. Now, you know, we do have other wines creeping into the thing that we've got our, you know, names on. I've got my name on a few personally and such like and as have other winemakers. But there's that lovely collegiate, that lovely team thing to support.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, so you might add a few new vineyards or parcels or a new grower or something like that, or change a cooper or something. Or,
Especially with the French oak. The French oak, we change tenders for coopers all the time. The American oak, we've got a great arrangement with AP John Coopers and the Barossa and, you know, across and even our enterprise now in California. We send over AP John barrels, fully intact, of American and French oak across to California. In France, of course, with our Bordeaux efforts currently, and we've got an enterprise over there, that the barrels don't have to come to Australia first. They stay in France. So, you know, carbon footprint perspective, it's not that bad. But vineyards are being planted all the time. We established whole new regions decades back, Robe, for example, in South Australia. We weren't the first in Rattenbully, but we really, you know, drive that quite. Coonawarra is huge for us. It's been there for a long time. We do establish new regions as well and vineyards.
Let's just, I'd like to talk a little bit about Max Schubert, the man who invented Grange, and amazingly, the story that he made in secret for 3 years on several occasions when the board told him to stop making it. I mean, I'm sure you met him. What was he like? And was he proud of his creation? Was he? I mean, he strikes me. He was probably quite stubborn as well as creative. He went on making this wine in secret.
Look, you could probably use the word stubborn, but you could also probably use the word humble. I think he looked at everything in perspective and didn't take it too seriously. But, you know, to hide three vintages of Grange under the threat of instant dismissal across 3 years, literally underground in the underground bins. You know, and as we know,
under the floorboards, as it were,
Well, in the underground drives, and he actually, like in the Second World War, had wooden just sort of sealed some of those bins. So, you know, he was determined, and he came from a culture again within Penfold going way back of new and different things. You know, nowadays when you use the word innovation, it sounds a bit, prim and proper and whatever, but he truly was. So, to believe in his own conviction. And then, you know, just to sort of risk it a little bit. And I think we've got that culture still happening at Penfolds. You know, we're part of a much larger group now, but the Penfold culture is very, very separate.
And he was extremely proud of his creation, I'd imagine, quietly satisfied.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, and his daughter, Sandy, his son, Brendan, I keep in close contact with. Thelma, his wife, widow, she only passed away a little while back. And we'd had her up to McGill quite often. And I think a lot of my memories of Max have been sort of reinforced by other people. He was very lucky, though. Dr. Ray Beckwith died a few weeks short of his 101st, so Ray actually firsthand told me a lot about the Maxisms, yeah. as has in recent times John Bird, who still comes to McGill. You know, John, over 60 harvests with Penfolds, retired some time ago, but this keeps the whole thing alive, yeah.
I mean, I just wonder, with an iconic red like that, how important is the secondary market to you?
Secondary market, look, in Australia it's huge, and Penfolds drives the Australian secondary market, whether we're talking Langtons, MW Wines, Sterling, and there are others. But offshore, we are not quite as prominent. You know, we deal with Christie's and Sotheby's with our recorking clinics around the world.
Yeah.
But I think the few wines that go offshore at a higher level tend to get consumed fairly quickly or guarded. So I think it's a great challenge for us to develop a greater secondary market sort of appearance, in other markets. But in Australia, I would say, yeah, we're the major force in the secondary market. It is very important. So we really must do things elsewhere out of Australia.
Well, and some of the most famous vintages of Grange sell for record auction prices, obviously, as well. But if you had to choose a kind of underrated vintage, what would it be if you were to say to somebody, do you know what, people just missed this vintage, it was brilliant.
Oh, great. I love, yeah. They're my favourite ones, the shadow sort of vintage. Yeah. 99 was missed in its day. 94 was missed. In the 70s, 71, legendary, 76, you know, 100 points off everyone, but not many people look at the 78.
Yeah.
It's an amazing wine. If it comes from a great cellar, today it can open up with blueberry fruits. It's the only Grange with a cork where 1978 wraps itself around the cork. So you always know if you've got the real thing.
You've got the real thing.
With our Rewards of Patience Edition 8, after over 60 years, my favourite Grange of all time, the 53, the 52 has finally overtaken it. But it's taken over 60 years for that to happen. The one that got all the accolades in the early years was the 55, and it was left behind by the 52 and the 53 a few years ago. But any one of those 350s can still score anything between 97 and 100 points today if they're well-cellared and of good provenance.
And which were the three wines that were made in secret, the three vintages?
The 57, the 58, and the 59, which actually utilised 1, 2, and 3-year-old oak, because you could hide the bottles. He could even get the bottling done, but he couldn't hide invoices for new oak. So we had accountants back in those days too. Yeah.
I love that. I mean, you make wines from single varieties, single vineyards, single regions, as well as multiple vineyards, regions, states even, and vintages in the case of your fortifies and the G3 and G4 blends that you've made. I just remember, for you, what are the advantages and disadvantages of blending all those different components?
Yeah. Look, we have defied a lot of, dare I use the expression, old world concepts of what wine should be. We love terroir, we love sense of place, and we do that with our single vineyard expressions. But we also love what the Champenois do in terms of, adherence to a house style or the pursuit of a stylistic template for particular wines. And we can achieve objectives of that, whether it be, I don't know, bin 389, we can elevate the status of it by getting better fruit off different vineyards, different soil types, and then blending. So the actual art of blending should be about synergy, the sum of the parts being greater than. Mm-hmm. And in Australia, we've been very lucky with the flexibility of where we can go and what we can do. Mm-hmm. And it's just quite magical, and I use that term magical deliberately, because when you add that and that and end up with that, you think, my goodness, where's the science there? What's the chemistry, physics of that? No one knows. I had Professor Brian Cox at the McGill Winery not so long back, and I showed him our G3 and its components. And as smart as that fellow is, the astrophysicist, his eyes were just whirling. He couldn't work out how that vintage, and that vintage gave you that. And I thought to me, isn't that wonderful? There is science, obviously, but some of it is a touch magical. And I find blending is something we can't always explain. And that's what's so palpable and convincing about the sum of the parts.
Yeah. So it's intuition sometimes, is it?
Well, it sort of is. And I often use McGill Estate. We have a monopole there, you know, 12 and a half acres, 5.2 hectares. And we'll pick that across oftentimes 2 to 3 days. And the material will be kept in separate blocks and go into any one of 8 different fermenters.
Mm.
We might relegate one or two of them. And sometimes one is stolen and elevated into Grange. I often feel sorry for McGill Estate Shiraz. But the remaining 3, 4, 5 parcels are combined. They're blended to create a single vineyard expression.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a mindset thing in a way. What we do with Cabernet, yeah, we tend not to use the Bordelais technique of throwing in a bit of Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot. We'll use Syrah. You know, we've just recently come up with what we call, you know, we needed a name for this, a super blend. Yeah. You know, like super Tuscan, super food. This is the great Australian super blend, Cabernet and Syrah, Cabernet and Shiraz.
Mm.
And that's all about the dovetailing and bringing the best of both varieties. But in this instance, it's at our flagship level.
Yeah.
You know, 389s at bin level, this is at the top of the range. We'll only do this 2 or 3 times in a decade.
And where would 707 sit in that?
707, yeah, is our flagship Cabernet. It's sort of our range of Cabernet.
Mm.
And sometimes fruit can be at an A1 grade level, what we call A1 grade, A2, A3, at the highest of level, but it might not suit the Grange style or the 707 style.
Yeah.
So now they have other things to aim for.
To go for, yeah.
Yeah, because growers take an enormous risk, and our own vineyard managers are Penfolds. And if it doesn't get to that level, it can cascade quite a way down. Now we have other wines to fill gaps.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just wondering, with climate change, obviously we've seen the pictures and read the reports, a very real feature of the Aussie wine landscape, literally. I would think we're going to see more people blending across regions to sort of mitigate risk.
Well, look, I think it would lend itself to that. I think part of why we do it and always have at Penfolds, you know, because we've had, thank goodness they left that McGill Estate site. They actually went up to the Bross. They went south to McLaren Vale, further south to Coonawarra, and ultimately left the state in many ways to make a little bit more, but also because of climatic variation.
Mm.
You know, South Australia, the driest state of the world's driest continent, it's always hot. It's always dry. So when we talk cool climate sourcing for our white wines in particular, we have to leave the state to go to the Snowy Mountains, to go down to Tasmania. And that creates a little bit of an insurance policy for us, gives us flex.
Mm.
Yes, Adelaide Hills can be terrific in some years, but not every year.
Yeah.
You know, we're a little later going to taste a 2020, like in California, we had fires. So thank goodness we weren't reliant on a certain part of the Adelaide Hills. We were able to go somewhere else.
Mm.
Now, it's not only fires. You know, quite often in the Northern Hemisphere, it's black clouds and rain or frost at the right time or whatever. So by dabbling in other areas, you really do reduce risk.
Mm.
So I think other people will take that on over time if they can, because so many wineries now aren't just a little chateau or a building, an edifice surrounded by a vineyard. Lots of other people now have vineyards in other regions for what you've implied.
Partly for those reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, we've mentioned the your luxury wines, your icons, which can sell at thousands of pounds a bottle or more, but you also make everyday wines. I mean, the Penfolds church, if you like, is welcome to all believers.
Absolutely.
You know, I just wonder, do you feel equally at home in both worlds? And I wonder, how hard is it to make large volumes of something that really delivers value for money for you?
Oh, look, this is, to us, our little playground, you know, at the Canunga Hill level, the lower bin level. You know, when Canunga Hill Shiraz Cabernet turned 21 years of age, you know, Don Dither started in 76, but John Duval, former chief wine, we split the world up and celebrated 21 years around the world. We poured 21 vintages of Canunga Hill Shiraz Cabernet. One of the greatest of experiences. A lot of journalists poured them out because they didn't believe that came from that bottle. I kid you not, top of the CNN Tower in Toronto, I can remember vividly. What are they doing? They re-poured their glasses out of those bottles. You know, that's a wondrous thing to me. One of your colleagues, this is, I think, a great story, Oz Clark, came to visit once, and he was running a bit late, very unlike Oz.
He's always running late.
Always running late. Anyway, this tasting set up of about 30 or 40 wines. And he said, we've got to have a meal afterwards. He said, just show me 2 wines. And he said, I can tell with those 2 wines, use them as barometers or whatever, to tell me everything that's going on in Penfolds. And the 2 wines were Canunga Hill Shiraz Cabernet and been 28. And he said to me at the time, quote, unquote, if something's going wrong with Grange or whatever, he said, you get the sack. He said, but they will tell me what's happening in the portfolio. And I thought, wow, I've never forgotten that. You know, it's so important, you know, those entry-level wines. Yeah. And then people quaff wines, they have special occasion wines of all sorts. And we're lucky to have a reasonably, you know, wide portfolio. Mm. But you start off somewhere and people, you know, wealthy people on Tuesday night, I can guarantee you're not drinking Bin 707.
No. Even you're not drinking Grange and Bin 707.
And I get the leftovers. Even yeah, I'm not. Exactly.
Exactly. Listen, we've mentioned this a lot, but Penfolds is seen by most consumers as a red wine brand. Mm-hmm. The whites, I think, are undervalued. I mean, they can be absolutely brilliant, not just Yatana, but all sorts of stuff, you know, from the Rieslings and other Chardonnays. Do you get the same thrill from making a Riesling or a Chardonnay as you do from a Shiraz or a Cabernet or a Red Blend?
Oh, look, we always have the late Neville Falkenberg, who helped us with the Yatana project in the early days, and a lot of the other whites. Our white winemaker, Kim Schroeter, you know, he is just purist, devoted to the cause of whites. The challenge is, though, in certain markets, Penfolds, they're a red wine house, and we've been chipping away at that now for a long time. So whether it be Riesling, Semillon, Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnay or whatever, there's now, oh, hang on, these things are like. And when we taste the Chardonnays later, we talk about those in the same way that we talk about reds, in terms of layers, complexities, that propensity to age. Mm-hmm. So the mindset's not that different. They're just different colours and from different varietals. But increasingly, watch this space, our whites are on the ascent and doing incredibly well in the Australian wine show system and also globally with international competitions. So there's an awareness happening now, and I think that will lead to something.
And also now your career's sort of gone full circle in a way, and you're now making sparkly wines again, just as you did at the start, but now you're in France, obviously, with Champagne Thiénot. Just tell us a little bit about that project and how it came about.
Oh, look, we've been wanting to do something like this for ages, but we never thought it would be possible. And to come and work with Stanislas Thiénot and his father, you know, like, it's just amazing. And their team, the Chef de Cave, Nicolas, it's just wonderful. They're a very worldly sort of group. They also have two other champagne houses and some chateaus in Bordeaux. So very forward-thinking, very futuristic, very worldly. And it's a marriage made in heaven, you know, like has been a little bit too easy. And to see now Penfolds on a label of champagne and the CIBC, the most regulatory of all regulating groups on planet Earth, I think it's fair to say.
I think you're right.
Quote, unquote, we love what Thiénot and Penfolds have done. They've done it right from the start.
Yeah.
So we went on the journey with them, and they didn't let me do a few things with Stanislas. We were going to add, in the liqueur, we're going to add a little bit of Yatana into each of the Blanc de Blancs. We have a lovely Grand Cru.
Are you
Blanc
doing
Blanc
that?
There. No, we weren't allowed to do that. And a little bit of Sinonry in the Blanc de Noir from AE. We weren't allowed to do that. But what we were able to do was send over Yatana Barriques, and that's where the Expedition Liqueur is housed. So there's a tiny, it's a long bow, I know, but there's a little bit of Penfolds Australia in those lovely bottles of champagne. And it's a top-down approach too, which is great. Within a month or two, we're releasing a non-vintage rosé, which is significantly less expensive than the three very top wines. So top-down approach is what we and people love the styles. And we love working. We launched it in Paris. We launched it at the Ritz. We had more French people there than Australians.
That was when you could travel, right?
Yeah, when we could travel. Remember those days? Yeah, exactly. Back in the day. Yeah.
I mean, let's talk about another C, which is not champagne, but China, a place where you've spent a lot of time, and Penfolds is, again, a huge brand there. I just wondered how the trade disagreement ongoing between Australia and China has affected you guys.
Oh, look, it has affected us. It's affected everyone. It's affected and will affect the world economy. You know, I started off working in China almost three decades ago, and back in the day it was difficult. People forget this. I was working with army generals and the military mainly. I kid you not.
They were driving around, were they?
Well, no. Glass to glass and chest to chest and off you'd go. And remember the very first one, I thought, I'm going to leave here horizontal. And I walked out. I didn't even know where I was walking back in the day. They didn't have signs back then in English or anything. You know, it was pretty rugged back then. But it's become so sophisticated. And, you know, there are many, many Australians and Americas in China by population, 1.4 billion people. But in the early days, a lot of it was linked to gifting and appearance, and then bit by bit, the love of wine has started. So I feel really sorry for Chinese red wine drinkers who love Penfolds.
Yeah.
You know, we were really spoiled with a red capsule in 128, in 28, in 389, you know,
lucky number. Lucky number in China.
Lucky,
right?
Lucky. Yeah. And how lucky. The word Penfolds, it said quickly, Penfolds means route to prosperity.
Oh, wow.
Now, like, how lucky, like all the stars aligned. Sadly, I was there. That would have set it back a little bit. But above and beyond that, we've been so lucky. But, look, we still have a great team working there, so it's not over yet. But we've got everything crossed that government to government. It has been just purely.
It'll come right.
That they'll fix it up at some point.
Yeah.
I hope.
I mean, where else in the world would you like to make wine? Let's have a wish list.
Well, we've been very fortunate, and we bought into Bordeaux recently, and we've already dabbled. There's a trial wine that might come out fairly soon and another Alliance wine. But, look, it would be great to do something in the Rhone. You know, if you look at Syrah, or what we call Shiraz, you know, Coles to Newcastle, I can say that, Newcastle upon Tyne.
Maybe that's the name of the brand. It's Coles to Newcastle. wouldn't sound very good in Chinese, would it?
No, look, to dabble there with two completely different styles and to do something, in a way, like in Bordeaux, we're not going to Bordeaux and saying we're going to show them how to dabble with Cabernet. What we're doing is it's through a Penfold lens. So it would be nice to dabble there in the Rhone, I think. And, yeah, how lucky, you know, if we're able to do it.
I'd love to see you do it. It'd be fantastic.
It would be good. You know, and it's the same with the Californian project. People didn't think, you know, oh, and it's just a flyby. And I think I mentioned with the Californian project, we started that back in 88 when we sent over a senior Penfold winemaker, Daryl Broom. We planted vines there in 98 and 99, Plymner cuttings, McGill cuttings. That's back in the last millennium. And then we released them in March of this year. That's our long-term sort of project.
Yeah.
The Bordeaux project, it's a foot in the water and watch this space. So maybe, fingers crossed, we might be able to go down the road. Who's to know?
In 2012, I think it was, I was there, you were voted winemaker's winemaker by the Institute of Masters of Wine and the Drinks Business. I mean, you've won so many awards, so I've lost count. Was that in some ways the most important of them, really, to be recognised by your peers, by this amazing peer group as somebody pretty special?
It was, you know, it was the second time awarded, so I was very humbled by that. But look, the other awards too, like how privileged to work for a group like this where I've already got the momentum going, you know, on the back of other generations of Penfold winemakers. But I think the one that resonated the most, because it had appeal for the world of wine across everything, and that was the Companion of the Order of Australia, which is the highest award in Australia. Yeah. There's, you know, that's the AC. They have an AM, they have an AO, and then an OAM. This is not many people get that. In fact, I think to this day, I'm the only person in the Australian wine industry who's been awarded that.
So it's like being a sir, really, is it?
In
a
way? Well, it's the old knighthood, in effect. Yeah. And you know, because we don't do that now, but it was in the Queen's Birthday Honours Awards, as distinct from the Australia Day Awards. And what they did for other people, they said, hang on, this thing called wine is pretty serious, isn't it? You know, an AC for someone in wine, an enologist, whatever that means, a winemaker. So, no, I think that had the most impact. Feel very proud about that.
Yeah.
And that was for, you know, global work and other bits and pieces. But, had bigger cachet.
I mean, you've mentioned this, your global work, and a huge part of your job pre-pandemic obviously involved travel. You're kind of a one-man brand ambassador as well as a great winemaker. I just wonder how much you've missed it. And is there one city in particular you think, oh, God, I really, when I can fly again, I can get out of Melbourne and cross, and get out of Australia. Where will I go? Where would you go first? Yeah.
Well, it's a funny thing. Who would have thought a year or two back anyone would say you missed the travel, because it's arduous, especially since September 11. It's just guttural, especially in the States and in many other countries. But I actually really do miss it. Obviously, I prefer to be at the destination rather than over an ocean at 35,000 feet. But, I don't know. I love going to London, you know, and I've got my own little place that, well, not my own little place. I stay in a particular hotel and they know me, I know them. Jump the channel and, you know, Paris, how could you be, like, wonderful? Or, look, how lucky to have had an occupation whereby I probably know New York more so than I know Sydney. You know, the streets, the lanes, the alleyways. Not quite so Paris. I would like it one day to be in that sort of position, but no, just it would be great to get back into all of that. But I think above and beyond this, you know, what we're doing now is in some ways a compromise, but pressing the flesh. We're in an industry where sipping wine, talking about wine, sharing wine, it's just such a human thing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you just have to engage. Yeah. Lucky, you know, we've known each other for a long time and I've had, you know, encounters over this screen and elsewhere with people I've known for, well, generations almost.
Yeah.
I feel sorry for younger people, younger wineries just starting off because they're competing against everyone. Yeah. But, yeah, can't wait for the time to get back on that plane and, traverse oceans again.
Will you travel as much as you did?
I don't think anyone will somehow. No. I travelled a lot. You know, in the second half of the year outside of our harvest, it was almost on average one day in two if you were to go back through the decades. Mm. And perhaps some of it wasn't really all that healthy. Mm. Now, there's nothing worse when you're giving a presentation in some distant country and you haven't been to sleep for 2 or 3 days and you're listening to this person talk. And you're agreeing with most of what you're hearing, then you realise you're listening to yourself talk half a second out of sync. You know, a true out-of-body experience. And that has happened now 2 times, and that is totally frightening. That's when you know, hang on, go to bed, get some sleep. This is dangerous.
It's like laughing at your own jokes, really, isn't it?
Well, you try not to.
I mean, your wife, Gail, used to be a very prominent politician in Australia, although she's retired in 2018. I once saw you guys described as Australia's power couple.
Oh, that's South Australia.
I just wonder, are there any similarities between the worlds of wine and politics? Or are they just, I mean, wine is politics in some senses, isn't it? But how many similarities are there between them?
Oh, look, there are so many, you know, the definition of politics to many people is where you've got three people gathered and you've automatically got a split of 2-on-1. You know, it's a numbers game. But no, communication, talking to people, a little bit of lobbying, both internally within the group that you work for and externally, the interfacing, the messaging. I think there would be a few similarities, but Gail often said to me at the time, because I know a lot of her friends, and, you know, former premiers, former prime ministers and all sorts of people, and she'd often say to me when I'd offer a little bit of advice every now and then, she'd say, Peter, I don't tell you how to make wine. So she never got past the side. You know, when I'd go a little bit too knowledgeably out there. But no, it's a very different, very different game, politics, to do it truly. But in her instance, and obviously I say it through a little bit of bias, she was totally into policy, and that's when she retired. She was the first female leader of the upper house in South Australia, minister for 10 years, did what she wanted to do, and then got out.
Okay.
You know, her former life was nursing, neuropsychology, other things. Got in. She had one day in opposition across 16 years. How lucky.
That's not a bad record, is it?
One day in opposition across 16 years. Yeah.
Last question. You've always been a person, as we've heard, with interest in other things, not just through Gail, but, I mean, I always enjoy talking to you about music and books and other things. How do you get away from wine? Is it, you know, do you need a safety valve, as it were, a pressure valve to let off a little bit of the wine stuff?
Well, look, it's a funny thing. With friends so often I say I get paid to do this. Like this is, you know, in a lolly shop sort of a career. But all roads lead to Roma, to wine somehow. And it is quite incredible. Like I can be with people you see on telly or music stars that you only see at Wembley and that. And you're just with them, you think, this is work. This is wine. It's the new golf, the new language of business. Call it what you will. So most things ultimately get back to it, but it interfaces with so many of my other interests. And it's such a natural thing. Like I started off, I tell friends, I didn't start off as a winemaker. I started off as a geeky person who didn't understand this thing. Mm. I got into it, found out a little bit about it, started to collect a few wines. I've got 2 cellars. Mm. I became a wine lover first, a wine collector second, a winemaker third. Yeah. And it has been real and it has been natural. And, you know, I'm very thankful for that.
And along the way, you get to drink Grange with Bono or something like that.
Well, we've been interfaced with a few, but including Bono. We sponsored the Red Project in Africa with him at one point. So, yeah, a little bit of time with a number of people over the years. But it is quite funny, actually. Like I was once held by Joe Cocker around the throat. He put me up against a wall because I was offering him something at the time that he was not allowed to drink. This is later in life. And I told him about something when I once saw him in another place. And he said, you could have given it to me then. I could have done something with this thing. You know, you're showing me this now, and very theatrically. Yeah. So to have those experiences, for Pink to come to Australia multiple times to McGill, you know, David Grohl, Foo Fighters, and Pat Smears to the original Nirvana. Whenever they're in Australia, they come up. They go to their shows, you know, now Foo Fighters or whatever. But jazz, Diana Krall, people like that. Mick Huntley in your city, you know,
yeah.
Simply Red, loves Australian Riesling. I try a few of his old wines and whatever. But, you know, it's just such an easy thing to do because you just talk to my mates, really, and a common thing music, a common thing wine, or a common thing whatever. Yeah. It has to be real. It has to be natural. I'll keep on repeating myself, I know.
Listen, it's been brilliant talking to you. I'm looking forward to Coles to Newcastle, that famous wine that you're going to make somewhere in the world, right?
There we go.
Peter, it's been lovely talking to you. I hope to see you very soon in Australia or in London or Paris or wherever.
Yeah, I hope so. May it be soon. Thank you,
thanks,
Tim.
Man. Bye.
Thank you. Okay, bye.
Well, you can hear why Peter was such a good teacher. He's just a natural communicator. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is Felipe Tosso from Viña Ventisquero in Chile. See you then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.